In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokin, Mira Salganik, and Yekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists, and artists, sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative, and fair.
So this week, we will continue to follow Libya, as NATO has decided to assume the control over military operation. Its ultimate goals are still debated. However, according to one of the versions, it's intended to force Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi to step down. We will then take a broader look at the rest of the Arab world, which faces more turbulence, reaching out as far as Syria. And finally, we will talk about Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's got involved in another corruption scandal. Our man in the news has approached the halfway mark of his second term this week, facing investigation into his family's vacation spending allegedly paid by private individuals. The accusations have not been confirmed yet, but the scandal is certainly something the Israeli government could do without amidst the growing turmoil.
So, as I understand, this week, almost the whole of the program is focused on the Middle East, be it the Arab world or Israel with its domestic political agenda, isn't it?
Do you mean that it's too much of the Middle East? Okay?
Yes, I feel it a bit too much.
Well, I understand your reservations, but there seems to be no way out of it right now. We have to think how this, so to speak, geopolitical tsunami and its aftershocks that affect the interdependent world we keep on talking about for the very simple reason that we are living in it.
Okay, so let's start with NATO's involvement in Libya. Beyond the headlines is our first heading, in which we'll discuss the transition of military's operations command in Libya from a, shall we put it, loosely modeled coalition of will to tightly structured North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Though described by U.S. Democrat Denis Kucinich as, and I quote, slate of hand over to NATO, the move marks another dramatic turnaround in the Libyan situation, doesn't it, Sergei?
Well, there are confusing reports coming from Libya, and actually it's very difficult to figure out who is actually getting control of the situation. But at the same time, it looks like after weeks of fierce fighting, the pendulum swung in opposite direction.
Opposite direction meaning what?
Meaning that Gaddafi maybe is not on the last legs, but his days are numbered, or weeks are numbered, I would say.
Especially as his foreign minister...
Defection
to the West.
That's a terrible blow, definitely, to the regime.
It shows
that the regime crumbles from inside.
From inside, that's right. But the tragic thing about this foreign minister is that he's also wanted for some of the terrorist acts.
That's it.
In the West.
That's a different story.
That's a different story. But anyway, that perhaps describes the turmoil Libya is living through now.
That's right.
Well, anyway, Gaddafi will not have another miraculous escape. I think that we can agree on this. Sooner or later, and the hot stage is still continuing, we don't know when it's going to end, but right now, much is hanging in the air.
That's right. Obviously, I've read a lot about Libya these days. But my impression is that what is at stake today is not only the change of Libyan leadership, is not only the loss, it's really tragic, loss of lives of civilians or perhaps control of Libyan oil. But the stake, to me, it seems that it should be much higher and it might not be directly related to Libya. So, Sergei, is my impression correct? Mira.
Well, since you have started with saying that the stakes are very, very high, and not directly related to Libya.
Well, that's my guess.
Yes, that's what you said.
That's right.
So I think that you do not mean the prognostication of who's going to win.
Militarily win.
Or win in general. Because this is not a stake high enough as the one Katz described, or I understood.
So you mean to say that the question is obsolete already now? It's quite clear that there's no way for Gaddafi to secure military victory.
Let me put it this way. I hope there is no way back, right? No hurry to make
But
you
you're
know,
moving
certain.
Away from my question. My
yes,
question
indeed.
Was about the stakes.
Yeah, let me come to it. So I'll put it this way. So now we are speaking about NATO. So I'll put it this way.
Oh, you meant NATO, Katya?
No, I meant the stakes and the whole of the situation.
Yeah, so let me put it this way. By taking control of the mission, NATO got involved in a very risky venture. It's like entering a minefield. Or let me put it, it's like playing a game of Russian roulette, if you wish.
Okay, but could you expand a little bit on that?
On Russian roulette?
Yeah, it's not easy, of course, but let me at least start. So, as I see it, for NATO, which found itself in a grip of severe identity crisis, and it was aggravated by the Cold War and the current mess in Afghanistan, Libya could turn out either last nail in the coffin or a sort of a wonder drug, bringing the aging and unhelpful alliance back to life.
So you're saying that the outcome of this test would largely depend on the timing and the manner of Gaddafi's departure and on who wins the other war, which is already in full swing. So let's put it, it's the global information war over Libya.
Sorry for interrupting you, but I'd say that in the current situation, or perhaps not only this particular situation, but these days, information warfare has acquired a special importance. It will be as effective as actual combat is. Sometimes it could be even more effective, for the simple reason that it doesn't end, the information war, when the last shot is fired.
But let me come back to NATO's identity crisis, which is my favorite topic.
Yeah. You know.
So symbolically, military operation in Libya comes less than 5 months after NATO's historic Lisbon summit, which spelled out new security doctrine, which aimed at overcoming identity crisis, as I understand it, and formulating the new cornerstone idea of the post-war NATO's existence. So, Libya's operation comes as the first serious test for NATO after its new military doctrine was rubber-stamped in Lisbon.
Test of what?
Test of maturity, test of ability to act in extraordinary situations.
Should I put it this way? Test of survivability, if you know what I mean. Whether it can survive the crisis or not at all. I think it comes to this. But anyway, I want to draw your attention to still another aspect. It's an open secret, of course, that anything related to NATO's activities becomes politically charged.
Highly charged issue, because it becomes
this issue overnight.
Not surprising, because NATO is A, political, and B, military organization.
Of course,
natural.
It should be this way. But few analysts in this charged atmosphere are capable being really retaining the objectivity of their judgment without sliding into this, you know, cries of NATO being the aggressor and this and that, or hailing it as the bearing of torch of democracy, etc., etc.
So for analysts, this is not also a question of not taking sides, as for NATO as well, conflict. Yeah. You know, Mira, as far as I am concerned, I don't want to spit in the face of aggressor, so to say.
Could you do that?
No. So why should I join the crowd of those who are doing this? This is not the case. But at the same time, nor do I buy the idea that NATO's sole goal in Libya is to protect civilians from Gaddafi's cutthroats. So, as I see it, in Libya, NATO will definitely follow its own hidden agenda, which has, I'm afraid, little in common with officially proclaimed goals.
You're confirming my suspicion, Sergei. But anyway, could you just expand a little bit on what you mean by hidden agenda?
Yeah, I'm coming to
it.
It's not a conspiracy theory.
There's a combination of quite pragmatic issues that shape the NATO's agenda, as I see it, in Libya. So, first, Libya is a very real challenge to NATO member state security. Let us admit it openly. Just imagine hundreds of thousands of potential refugees from the region who are seeking shelter in Europe, then threat of humanitarian catastrophe, then disruption of oil and gas supplies and other factors. There are many factors.
Okay, Sergei. So, one of the key points in NATO's Libyan agenda, you're talking about Libyan agenda now, not the overall
NATO's Libyan agenda. Threats and challenges for NATO and member states.
Okay, but just let me sum it up. You're saying that one of the key points in NATO's Libyan agenda, and I stress Libyan, is the speediest possible settling of the conflict and ensuring a smooth transition of power. But how about a larger NATO agenda?
That's right. That's only one point. We also have to keep in mind that for NATO, Libya is also providing a chance, maybe unique chance, to test its transatlantic solidarity, to boost, so to speak, team spirit, which has largely eroded, if not totally evaporated in recent years.
But the bigger the organization, the lower is the point of the team spirit. But do I get it right that you're referring to a test on NATO's ability to take collective decisions, share responsibility, and ultimately show that it can act as a global fire brigade or police team, for instance?
Well, I remember a joke about NATO privately traded by a British defense analyst at a security conference in UK a few years ago. Do you know how we identify NATO? He asked me with a sort of a cunning smile. It's not what you think. NATO means no action talk only. Or North Atlantic Travel Office, whatever you like. This is what he said, you know.
Sergey, listen, I really must remember this one. It's too good to forget.
So now they're supposed to show that they can take action, you see. This is not only a talk show.
Well, in this respect, the Libyan operation is a chance to show that NATO is neither
a talk show.
Neither a talk show nor a travel office for its bureaucracy.
Nor a travel club for its
bureaucracy.
Because
it was never a travel club or talk show for the rank and file.
And there's also other experts. Libyan operation is also an attempt to show that NATO alliance is not a one-man show, dominated and controlled by American giant, while Europeans are dependent, passive on Lucas.
And finally, you know, the very fact that in Libya, NATO acts with the mandate from the UN Security Council, its resolution, that NATO acts on this one, it is seen as an instrument to show new face of NATO, which, after the Balkan Wars, has acquired the global nickname of an international or world policeman.
Well, but what's the big difference between the Balkan situation and the situation here? I mean, referring to the functions of NATO in the two situations, many analysts tend to compare them. But anyway, my dear experts, whatever you're saying seems fine, but it doesn't answer my ultimate question. And I believe that we're actually trying to tackle questions that lie in two different spheres. But if we come back to NATO's role in Libya, do I get to try that the scenario of NATO's rejuvenation in Libya, which you're referring to, Sergey? Well, to me, it looks a little bit far-fetched. But still, there are too many buts, which make it extremely difficult for the alliance.
That's what I was saying. The devil is in details.
That's right. That's right. And I agree with that. So, first of all, we don't know. There are no clearly set goals, at least known to the public. There is no clearly set strategy. There is no clearly set strategy of exit,
right.
Which means there's a lot of question marks in the whole situation. But NATO would definitely score points in Libya only if its mission is brief. And I heard some estimates if the mission is no longer than a month, right? But if it's restricted to airstrikes without land operation, and if it brings quick fall of Gaddafi regime. So there are big question marks about land operation too.
The other question is how to avoid the massive loss of civilian lives, which would become a major factor in that information war.
Not only in information.
And finally, another question which is related to information war. This, in fact, the most difficult thing for NATO would be to prove that alliance really is not taking sides in the conflict, that it is not supporting the rebels.
But it is.
Sorry, to me they have taken sides.
Of course.
I don't know.
Yes, yes.
It's quite
but they deny it. They deny it still.
That's the information. What's the information?
Listen, I would deny it too if I were in their shoes.
Okay, so do I get to try that there are strong doubts about NATO being geared for
Yes, if you like to be polite.
Yes. So all in all, it seems that in Libya, NATO is playing Russian roulette, which Sergey referred to, while not fully understanding the gravity of the situation for itself. But this is something I'm not buying. I think they're well aware of the gravity of the situation. And that is why. That is why they took so long to take a decision to assume control over the operation.
And the final scenario is that almost inevitable demise of Gaddafi's regime would likely mean new humiliation for NATO. I'm sorry to say this.
Why not?
If not his demise.
Oh, could you expand a little bit on that? Because what's the logic?
But we were speaking about two big buts. It seems that already the plan is not working in that way. You see, just NATO is not geared for cleared victory.
There
so no question of victory. Definitely they will win. They will outnumber. They would outpower Gaddafi regime.
But you remember, Sergey, there was a similar logic in Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
What we are seeing now.
Absolutely.
No, but Afghanistan is a different thing.
Why? Yeah, everybody says that it's a different thing. But what's so much different about it?
No, there is a lot of difference.
No,
what I would like to say, if I may, I do believe it's premature even to mention the demise of NATO.
I think it's a little bit too far-fetched.
That's what I mean.
But anyway, setback. Another setback, another accumulation.
Sergey,
if you insist, another step to demise.
Which, well, we get back to the issue of the image of NATO, to the issue of information wars. And now I suggest we could turn to our expert, Alexander Ritov, professor with the Moscow-based Institute of International Relations.
I think that, of course, the situation in Libya is not a usual test for the unity and solidarity inside NATO. And as you remember, the first stage of the operation was participation of the separate countries, not under the control and command of the NATO. and France, Italy, Canada, United Kingdom, and the United States were the first countries which interfered. But, of course, not all the countries in NATO supported it openly, and some of them noted and declared that they are not participating. Among those countries, we can mention Germany and Poland. That's why I think the idea to consolidate the NATO countries and to show, at least on the surface, the solidarity and mutual understanding, this intention played a big role in passing the command of all the operation to NATO. It means that all 28 countries, members of this organization, declared that they agree to participate. And of course, it doesn't need, for example, for Germany to show its share in this operation, or maybe to Poland. The operation is done by NATO, and all the responsibility for this operation is shared between all the countries of the alliance. I think that this stage and this war will not be easy, because, of course, it's not only the war against the army, it is the war against the group of population, and the success of this war, of course, bring NATO together, will prove the necessity of its existence. But at the same time, we see that the operation in Afghanistan is lasting so many years without any special result. We see this in Iraq. We remember the bombing of Serbia and the situation in Kosovo in 1999. And, of course, not all the countries of the European Union, of NATO, perceived those events positively. So if the situation in Libya continues to be so strained and unsolved, and NATO will not reach quick result, it will show the weaknesses. And, of course, any involvement into the war shows not only the power, but also shows a lot of weaknesses and makes the enemy of today's NATO more strong, knowing their shortcomings, knowing the weak spots of the alliances, not only from the point of view of military resistance and military confrontation, but as well from the point of view of the information war. The information war in this concrete situation aims at showing new perspectives for the Libyan people, but the perspectives and the material flourishing, not even flourishing, but maybe some kind of calm, quiet situation in the country is also a very important factor in this concrete situation. And if NATO and its allies and the opposition in Libya will not be able to offer to the Libyan people more or the same level of life they had during Gaddafi time, of course it can bring about new tensions, new problems, and maybe the split not only in Libya, but in other countries of Maghrib and Middle East and the Persian Gulf, new tensions in their relations with the developed countries, with NATO and maybe European Union as well. Of course, NATO, it's a military organization, and its aim is to play the soldiery role. Of course, the countries which are members of the Security Council of the United Nations, which are members of the NATO, like the United States, France, and the United Kingdom, of course, bear big responsibility for the success, for the solution of the Libyan problem. And, of course, the military victory is only the beginning in the big process of settlement in this country. And again, I am returning to my position that only very interesting and important for the Libyan people proposals and offers from NATO countries, from the world community, can really make the situation quiet and calm it down. Otherwise, if it will look like the fight for oil and fight for the natural resources of Libya, and the riches of the country will become the ownership of European or American companies, of course it will bring about some new tensions, some new problems. So the aims of the operation, real aims, and the information war aims should be really very good, coordinated, in order to reach the success. And of course, for Russia, it will be very important to be at the distance from the war, and of course, to try to keep economic interests and economic presence in the country at the same level, and not to lose a lot after the fall of the Gaddafi regime. course, this situation when the United Nations has supported this action changed the situation and changed the approaches we had before. Because before we had China and Russia, which were always against, which were vetoing any move, in Iraq, in Serbia. This time when Russia and China, with their abstention, in fact, supported the operation in Libya, it will be very important for NATO to find new balances and new equilibrium in their relations, not only with the Arab world, but with China and Russia, to keep them as their supporters or maybe as the countries which can provide abstention and not to block in general the idea and to create new reality of compromise, of agreement and of common visions of many European problems and their solutions. As we already said during our talk, NATO is able to win the information war on the first stage. But this victory is a little bit vulnerable and very, very fragile, as only the future developments and the participation of the world community in the reconstruction process, in building the democracy, in creating the state which really suits to the majority of the population, can prove the aims and support the position of NATO and their military involvement. Only positive developments can do such a support and could be a real evidence of the fact that the position of NATO was true and was right.
Well, Mr. Rytov, thank you very much.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
And now we are turning to Red Lion's second heading, Between the Lines, where we usually discuss what we consider to be the most notable publication of the week. And this time we have selected a story entitled The Middle East Crisis Has Just Begun. It was written by Robert Kaplan, who is a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, and it was published by The Washington Post. So the basic idea of this story is that despite the military drama unfolding in Libya, the Middle East is only beginning to unravel. And what's been happening this week only proves his forecast, by the way. So there are new countries getting engulfed by the way of popular unrest. There have been mass anti-government protests in Syria, and quite unprecedented in Bashar al-Assad's 11-year rule, not to mention Yemen's President Saleh, whose leaving power is now a matter of weeks, at least the way it seems to me.
You forgot to mention Bahrain and Jordan, Kurt, which are also in the risk zone.
Well, I haven't mentioned them yet. But Bahrain has already developed something what looks to me as a full-scale Shia uprising that has been rather brutally oppressed, with Saudi security forces stepping into the kingdom. But this is not big news. It's been there for quite a while. But yep. As for Jordan, yeah, I agree that Jordan remains in the risk zone. But what's interesting to me is Mr. Kaplan's effort to analyze the trend and to find out where it could finally bring the Middle East and the whole of the world. And however, naturally enough, he's mostly interested in what America stands to gain or lose from the Middle East democratic revolts, the way they're described. But whereas we in Moscow would like to know how the regional upheaval could affect Russia's interests.
Though it is not clear that in today's interdependent world there could be no exclusive victory for any nation, be it Russia or America. Still, I think we can agree with Mr. Kaplan's warning, which sounds like a gloomy prediction for all of us, Americans, Europeans or Russians. Here is what he writes. Darker terrain awaits us elsewhere in the region, where states will substantially weaken once the carapace of tyranny crumbles.
That's not a novel prediction, let alone American interests. I'm sure that the international community should be happy if democracy triumphs in the Middle East, except that it's wishful thinking.
Yes, Mira, and weak quasi-democratic governments, which are likely to emerge, at least in some of the Arab countries, may open doors for blatantly undemocratic regimes.
Oh, yes, but it's only one of a number of viable scenarios.
Yeah, but let me follow. Radical regimes may come to power by democratic elections, like Hamas, for instance. Though, as we all know, election is not the only way for, say, Islamic fundamentalism to come to the power.
Well, it's okay, but that's what democracy is all about, you know. It's about the power of the people, and that's the precise translation of the word democracy. But then I think the power of popular protest should eventually produce a viable government. So in that respect, Mr. Kaplan seems to be right, saying that And I quote, coverage by Al Jazeera can help to overthrow a government, but it can't help to organize new government.
Well said.
No doubt.
Actually, there's only one thing that can be predicted with certainty. The Middle East has entered an era of weakening central authority, and it would inevitably lead to forming of new political and economic reality, whether we like it or not, both in the Middle East and beyond.
But then, coming back to the Washington Post story, which is exclusively focusing on American interests, I would like to quote what Mr. Kaplan writes. I think it is worth considering, though the quote is large, but I'm sure you'll appreciate it. It goes like, Yemen, Jordan, Iraq, Bahrain, and the other Gulf states are all individually more important than Libya because they constitute Saudi Arabia's critical near abroad. The core question for the United States will be which regime lasts longer, Saudi Arabia's or Iran's. If the Saudi monarchy turns out to have more staying power, we will wrest a great strategic victory from this process of unrest. If Iran's theocracy prevails, it will signal a fundamental eclipse of American influence in the Middle East.
So he suggests that the U.S. policymakers give up the simplistic call for Arab democracy, stay out of the domestic affairs of the region, and keep American powder dry for crisis ahead. So I think the prognostication is mercilessly convincing. And he admits that it is not democracy that actually matters for the United States, but her national interests. But does it mean that Russia should also follow her interests, or it doesn't?
Well, that depends on whether you think that everybody should follow a bad example or not. But anyway, this is not what I wanted to say. Being a realist, and I would say a very down-to-earth man, the author declares, we should not kid ourselves. In foreign policy, all moral questions are really questions of power, right? Mr. Kaplan goes on to add, helping the Libyan rebels does not affect our interests, so we stand up for human rights there. But helping Bahrain's embattled Shia or Yemen's anti-regime protesters will undermine allies. So we do nothing to help demonstrators being killed in the streets.
Well, which means that perhaps explains his phrase that President Barack Obama has steered a reasonable middle course, you know?
Well, I'm not sure it has. He meant exactly this. And, you know, Katya, I've been thinking about Obama, who is so often called weak and feeble and whatnot. Don't you think that the President Obama is more restrained than his predecessor Bush? Why? Because he's the first American leader of the post-Cold War era and has to face absolutely new, perhaps not absolutely, but still new power balances. That brings me to another very interesting point in the Washington Post story, the role of China in the background of the ongoing Middle East drama.
Is there any role, Mira?
Wait a sec, as if you didn't know it. Listen what Kaplan says. He, as he put it, China is not a responsible stakeholder in the international system as we proclaim it should be. It's a free rider.
Which Mr. Kaplan doesn't like. Well, I understand this irritation. Americans are fighting in Afghanistan while Chinese are getting admirals and medals there. Americans have liberated Iraq and now Chinese are getting at Iraqi oil and so on and so forth.
Well, but that's a traditional Chinese policy, just to watch the two tigers battle some way
that
beneath.
That monkey on
right.
That's
and the
right.
Wise monkey
that's right.
Is beyond the battle.
And then, second, what is permissible to America? Shouldn't it be? Permissible to China? Why not?
But are you saying that his indignation contradicts his own principle, right? All moral questions are really questions of power. Or what is advisable for the U.S. should be taboo for China. Is it what you're saying?
Exactly. Isn't it so? Almost in the same breath, he says that we should not kid ourselves.
Mira, the message one gets from reading this story is that America is finding herself between two fires. The weakening of the central authorities, of her time-tested allies in the Middle East, and China's fast-growing expansionism.
Well, as for China, according to Kaplan, and I quote, we'll have economic and political problems of its own ahead that will interrupt its rise. And I'm not sure,
Well, I don't know actually how predicting troubles for China could possibly help America in her present troubles.
How could it help anyone?
Anyway, Mira, the Washington Post story concludes with a tell-tale warning. Order is preferable to disorder. Just consider what happened to Iraq after we toppled Saddam Hussein. The U.S. should not want Iraq's immediate past to be for state of the region's future.
Well, he could have done well telling it to President Bush back in 2003.
Obviously, an emergence of weak interim governments as the result of so-called democratic disorder or democratic havoc in some Arab states is the last thing Russia wants. Yet, this seems to be a possibility to be taken into account.
What kind of possibility?
Possibility of a new disruption of order in the Middle East.
Which can jeopardize
Russia's interests, vital interests.
It could jeopardize any world power's interests. It is a key region.
But we have to see what is our agenda and
matters
for us.
But in our interrelated world, I disagree, Sergei.
Of course, we could discuss it, should discuss Russia's interests. But just a second ago, we said that no one nation, whether you like it or not, could possibly gain alone from a mess of this proportion.
Well, Russia is hardly mentioned in the Washington Post story we are discussing.
Well, we see your point, Sergei, and of course...
We have to understand what is Russia's game, what are Russia's priorities, what are Russia's interests.
But would you agree if I tell you that Russia is going to lose even more than the United States from the havoc in the region? Because for the simple reason that it is much closer to Russian borders.
Both yes and no, but this is a long story. So
anyway,
I think we'll discuss it in another program.
But we can discuss it in another program. And it's worth it.
And it's worth it. But perhaps we could turn to another our guest speaker, which is Vladimir Sotnikov, Senior Research Fellow with the Institute of Oriental Studies, Russian Academy of Sciences.
The situation in Libya and the ongoing civil war and the interference on behalf of Western powers is not yet very clear what the situation might be leading to in Libya. So I think that the most probable scenario could be that after Libya came the turn, probably some other African Arab country, like Morocco, for example, or the situation in Yemen actually is not very much good, because, and Syria also, because the popular unrest and upheaval still are taking place in this country. So I think that this actually theory of domino effect proved to be very precise for what is going on nowadays in Arab East. From the point of view of Washington politicians and Washington-based analysts, Washington is actually fighting now between the desire to have the Saudi Arabia as its closest ally in the Middle East and to fight off the Islamic Republic of Iran. It is an arch-evil enemy in the Middle East and Near East too. So from the point of view of Washington policymakers, yes, they are right to some sort, because they are thinking in terms of continuing domination of the United States in the Middle East and preserving their vital interests, which include oil supplies, which include supporting of Israel on every occasion, and which include fighting against continuation of Iranian nuclear program. But from the point of view, for example, of Russian national interests, I think this Washington Post scenario, though I share the view of this author who actually predicted that the ongoing crisis in the Middle East entered actually the second stage, I share with this view. So from the point of view of Russian Federation, I think that we are not actually stand for having a closest allies or a bitter enemy. We are continuing to follow the line of maintaining good relations with all Arab states, whatever the upheaval, whatever the revolutions could take place in the Arab East. And I think that the recent position of the Russian Federation in the United Nations Security Council, as it is known, Russia abstained from voting for directing a military intervention on behalf of the NATO allies and the USA in Libya, showed that Russia is actually permanently keeps in mind the strengthening of good neighbored and friendly relations with Arab states, with whom, during the back old Soviet days, the Soviet Union has a very good relation. So I think that the points of view of American side and Russian side are very much divergent here. And that means that we have certain things in common with the United States. But to a major question, whether our political interest coincides with American interest in the Middle East, these views are divergent. The vital question always in such kind of crises, whenever they happen in the world, is who actually cares and who gets all the benefits from these crises. So I think that still it is very much unclear Who is standing behind the ongoing crisis in the Middle East? It is evident that it's not the United States who actually are benefiting from this crisis, because Washington was very much hesitating, as it's known, of interfering militarily in the Libyan civil war. But at the same time, the major players in the Middle East, I mean, first of all, of course, the Western powers like Italy, Germany, France in the first turn, the United States, of course, they think in terms of preserving their, first of all, economic interests, because the economy lies on the surface of every major national interests of these countries. And the problem for the world and for Arab world and for Russia as well lies in the area when this Libyan crisis would be over, and I think that it would be over sometimes in the future. Who will benefit mostly from the gains which this one could get because of this crisis? I think, unfortunately, that is not the case for Russia, because Russia could only preserve their national interests only by preserving good relations with Arab states and maintaining their economic interests. And Russia, by the way, can actually have one benefit because of this Libyan crisis. That is the oil and gas supplies, because I think that Libya, whatever the future government could be, if the regime of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi fell, if it would be still maintaining the power, Russia, by strengthening its relations with all Arab countries, including those countries who are under unrest, could promote its vital economic interests. And as for the West, I don't think so that the West could gain considerable gains from the nowadays crisis in the Middle East. Because what could be the overall scenario for all these crises which we are witnessing in the Middle East now? The West proclaims that it is supporting the democratic revolutions in the Middle Eastern countries. But this is just a pretext, because what can actually take place that under the signboard of the so-called democracy or establishing democracies in these Arab countries which are experiencing popular upheaval and unrest, there might be the third force. These are Islamists. These are a kind of Al-Qaeda sort forces, like Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, like Islamists in other countries, which could go out from the shadow and take up all the key positions in these countries. And that would be the case when nobody could gain anything from this ongoing crisis. I think that, strange to say, but first of all, I would name the United States, because the United States has a lot of to lose, because we already know that the United States are closely tied up in two bloody wars in the Muslim world. This is Iraq, though the United States withdrew the significant portion of its forces from Iraq, and ongoing war in Afghanistan. So the third war, whatever the actions from the side of the United States could be, I mean that they probably would decline of continuing the military operations on the ground in Libya. But they have much to lose, much more than, say, Italy or France or Western Germany or even Great Britain. Because the latter are NATO allies and they are pursuing their strategy within the allied strategy regarding their policies in this crisis. But, of course, the major player behind the backs of all these countries are the United States. And the United States, I think, would have much more to lose than any other Western country in the world.
Well, Mr. Sotnikov, thank you very much.
This is the Voice of Russia.
And now time has come to turn to Red Lion's concluding heading, which is Man in the News. And this week the man is going to be Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, who approaches the halfway mark of his second term of office amidst a loud corruption scandal. So it has been revealed that Mr. Netanyahu and his family, the report puts it, had extravagant spending on first-class tickets and lavish hotel rooms paid for by private donors, his wealthy friends in Europe and the United States, some of whom have business interests in Israel. So the story goes back to the year of 2008, when Mr. Netanyahu was a member of Knesset and the Minister of Finance. It was made public last week by a private TV channel, 10 program, that was followed by newspaper publications. So investigation was started by the state controller, who is supposed to look into the legal and ethical aspects of the prime minister's behavior. Now, the conflict entered a new stage after Mr. Netanyahu this week filed suit against a television channel and newspaper which had accused him of taking trips at the expense of private business. So it is reported that the libel suit against private Channel 10 and the Ma'ariv daily is seeking damages of 1 million shekels from each, saying many of the facts reported were false and aimed to ridicule and humiliate Mr. Netanyahu. So that's the way the story looks like.
Well, actually, from the very start, I mean, when they first read and heard about it, the whole thing did have a whiff of a mudslinging campaign. Look, trips abroad, paid by rich friends or donors, whatever you call them, a waitress, if you please, telling the press that Netanyahu didn't pay for his meals, but finally gave her an insulting tip. A leather bag Netanyahu gave to the obstetrician who oversaw his wife's sour delivery. Really?
How about trips abroad? They're absolutely natural.
Leather bag, sir. So I understand his anger and his determination to sue media. However, I personally don't think that this is an appropriate way to build up working relationship with media, whatever your reservations might be over the publications. We have some other examples, like Silvio Berlusconi was trying to sue European media, as you remember. And I think that some publications might have bad smell, really, but fighting with national media also smells bad.
But you know what? As a media person, I know pretty well that if I publish a story with accusations like these, I need to have 100% proof evidence,
Of professional ethics of journalists.
Of professionalism.
Professional standards, ethics, yes.
That's right.
But on the other hand, what I'm saying is that national leaders should not get involved in fight with national media.
It's downright slander.
I'm not talking about this situation in particular. No. Because we never know whether
Absolutely
Mr. Netanyahu is right or wrong. Because the state controller said that if proved true, Netanyahu's behavior was unacceptable, which means that the state controller has not yet carried out his investigation.
On the other hand, if proven true, Israel is a democratic country. Coming back to the specific scandal we are talking about, not taking the issue in general, so Israel is a democratic country. It is actually the only democracy in the Middle East. And let me remind you of Netanyahu's predecessor, Yehud Olmert, who has been also forced, who has been forced to resign on charges of corruption, and he's now on trial.
Well, corruption scandals are often in democracies.
Corruption is a worldwide disease, and it doesn't spare democracies, of course. But the difference between democratic and non-democratic countries is in their way and manner of fighting corruption. But what bothers me is the problem of how to draw a line of division between freedom of expression and information free for all.
What do you mean by the information free for all?
Well, I mean that mudsliding campaign which affects national leaders also.
But that's part of the political process. Remember last week we talked about the Indian Prime Minister, Mr. Manmohan Singh.
I see certain similarities in that.
Yeah, but he is known for his integrity, but of course there could be corrupt persons in his government. But still, it's also a political issue in election campaigns. So this is nothing new.
It's nothing new, Gaza, but it's really a very pertinent question. Well, how to draw the border line? How to draw a division line?
But anyway, today we're speaking about Netanyahu, and obviously we have to think over how this fresh corruption scandal would develop. But let us also understand that all voices of Israel agree that the priorities of the people there are not the corruption, but security and economic situation, both of which are relatively good at the moment. I emphasize that relatively good. I can't call them really good. So, moreover, Netanyahu was successful in navigating the economy through the global recession without any drastic impact. And since Netanyahu came to power 2 years back, in 2009, Israel has not been engaged in any major military confrontations with its neighbors. Those provocations are taking place almost every day. And this also goes to his credit. While the situation definitely is still explosive and the shadow of new intifada, the Palestinian uprising, is looming over the region, that's no doubt.
However, there is another question of, so to speak, Netanyahu's political identity. Though he represents Israeli right, He is the chairman of Likud Party, which is a rightist party. Dr. Michael Fage, I hope that I pronounce his name correctly, from the Research Institute for the Study of Israel and Zionism at Ben-Gurion University, said that judging Netanyahu's performance is very much a question on where one stands politically.
This may be so, but it isn't a paradox, and Prime Minister Olmert was known as a man of peace, yet Israel has fought two wars during his term office in 2006, a war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Operation Cast Lead in 2008 against Hamas in Gaza. So Netanyahu, for all criticism from the left that he did not do much to improve relations with the Palestinians, is often called a lefty on right-wing ticket.
Well, but still,
good formulation.
Good formulation.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's get back to the scandal. I think that scandals like this one are never timely. However, this seems to be a particularly sensitive moment for a scandal like the one we were talking about. So no doubt there's anxiety over the new and fast-changing situation in the Middle East, and Netanyahu was forced to delay his recent visit to Moscow by 4 hours due to an explosion at a bus stop in Jerusalem, and there's been a new upsurge in tensions between Israelis and Palestinians.
Well, and President Medvedev, while welcoming Netanyahu, who was late but for obvious reasons, said, "We are more than right to hold this meeting, as the terrorists must know that they do not achieve their wicked goals." And he also described the changes that underway in the Middle East and North Africa as tectonic shifts. And finally, President Medvedev emphasized that they cannot but affect the overall situation, and we as partners should discuss them.
As for Mr. Netanyahu, he compared events in the Middle East and North Africa to natural disasters, the type of that struck New Zealand and more recently Japan. Well, I guess that from Israel, the destabilization of several Arab states could look like forming of tsunami, which is hard to prognosticate, leave alone to prevent.
Oh, by the way, what about Iron Domes, which, just to remind our listeners, mobile air defense system? I've seen some reports that Israel is negotiating to sell some Iron Domes to Brazil, Singapore and India. Is that correct?
Well, before they get this, so to speak, this stamp of a battle proven, I don't know. Anyway, you know, Kurt, that there are the problem, or rather the issue of Iron Domes is very hotly debated in Israel.
So this is the system aimed at just protecting their neighboring areas from Hamas attacks, as I understand.
Look, you have found the right person to ask this question. Probably Kurt would help. I have not the foggiest, but the general idea, the overall idea one gets is that there is a kind of a dome, a roof, to be put all over the country or the sensitive points.
A sort of a batteries which are killing the bloody things which are coming from the
sky. I don't know. I'm not a military expert. What I would like to say is that while Yehud Barak, who is the defense minister, insists that this Iron Dome is to be deployed within days, Netanyahu himself is trying to lower, is probably the kind of a reply to your question, lower expectations about the Iron Dome system. He even told his cabinet that the system could not protect every house, every school, every army base in the country.
Well, you're not telling me that Israel is helpless in the face of the growing turmoil in the Middle East, are you?
No, I don't think it's helpless, but, Katz, don't you think that the idea of putting a dome over a whole country
is... I don't think it's the only solution. But the whole situation looks so complicated that I really feel we now need to turn to our next guest speaker, who is Yevgeny Satanovsky, president of the Moscow-based Institute of the Middle East.
That's no chance that anybody in ultra-left or left Israeli media, which usually try attack the politicians of the right camp, will they represent the prime minister office or minister of defense, minister of foreign affairs, or the president, we know the history of the president Moshe Katsav, which will have now 7 years in prison because of attack of mass media. So it's no chance that in the case of Netanyahu, Israeli mass media will have any possibility of doing something with him. Thus, that's absolutely usual situation for all the politicians in the whole world. That's not the corruption in the style of Berlusconi or Sarkozy. Because when the Nicolas Sarkozy is attacked by a Libyan leader with the question, where are the $50 million which were present to the French president by the leader of the Libyan revolution, that's the real question for media. The question about ideas that Netanyahu was a guest in some American house Even if the owner of this house was a rich man, it's not a question of anything like that. So Netanyahu have a stable situation, and he have, I think, guaranteed for the next year or year and a half that nobody can replace him from his position. First of all, there are no relations between Palestinians and Israelis. There is no chance for Palestinian leadership will really decide to build the Palestinian state more than the only which Palestinian leadership is doing. For a long time, when these people embezzle annually $2 billion from the world community, mostly from the United States and Europe, and the last dream they have, the really state, which will be very poor with some troubles, and which anyway will stop for this nice time when they have all money in their hands and can promise without delivering. So Netanyahu have a lot of things in economy, political stability, legitimization of his position and his government, and very strong position in security, much better than it was in the previous time. All these revolutions around Israel and problems in Syria, in Jordan, revolution in Egypt, the troubles in Yemen, give him free hand and clear understanding that the last conflict on the Middle East is interesting to anybody, is the conflict between him and Palestinians. And if he has a new partner, rather the people in Ramallah and Gaza whose activity provoke anti-Israeli terror, his priority will be anti-terror campaign, rather than the so-called peace process, which is no process and have no peace as any predictable result. Maybe Minister of Foreign Affairs, Avigdor Lieberman, is potential the next leader of Israel. With all problems which left camp or radical anti-Israeli Knesset like the members from the Arab parties will have with this prime minister. But he have a very strong chance for being leader on the national level. Sooner or later, he will be, I think, Minister of Defense and the Prime Minister of this country. And just now, of course, there are some other people who can play this game, like Gideon Saar. Just now, he's a Minister of Education also. But there is nobody on the left camp. Exactly. There is time when there is no more left camp in Israel. And the formal right leaders who represent the left camp, like Tzipi Livni, also have a very little resource of trust is from the electorate. Even when they accumulate all the left and central electorate in the Kadima Party. But, of course, the only possibility to stop terror is to destroy all the infrastructure of terror, including the military infrastructure in Gaza, which exactly will be the result of the next military operation of Israel, which sooner or later will be organized against Hamas in this territory. And in Lebanon, which sooner or later exactly will be organized by the Israeli army against the Hezbollah on the South Lebanon. Just now, all these territories are used by the Iranian Republic as their plotted arms against the Jewish state. And anyway, even without the direct war between Israel and Iran, Hamas and Hezbollah have no chance in the future years.
Well, Mr. Sitanovsky, thank you very much. And with this, we end this edition of Red Line, brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by its founders, Mira Salganik and Sergei Strokin, who is also the political observer in Kommersant, and myself, Yekaterina Kudashkina. So thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye and take care.
Take care and goodbye.
So long.
Bye.
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 So long.